Recording. Okay. Good afternoon. So last time we talked a bit about implementing application level sandboxing. We're reviewing that, well, we have these difficulties in that, you know, we could filter out what operations an application could do, but if we're thinking of confining sort of traditional applications like word processors, it's actually very hard to do this in a way which makes sense to the user as far as making sure what the application ends up doing, even if it gets compromised, doesn't exceed what the user was trying to let the application do. And we saw that there's some sort of solutions to this where we're looking at how we can integrate sandboxing into the user interface. And mobile phones, sort of with their sort of application permissions, have done this maybe in a more extreme way. We saw some sort of simple ideas. So one idea was that for things like selecting files, you know, if that process is supposed to happen from a user having a file selection dialog, well, we can have that be a service the sandbox application uses rather than just giving the application access to all the files the user might try to open. We also saw an example of cubes, or sort of as probably one design for, you know, trying to show users you're running these different, you know, isolated environments for applications where you might be concerned about information leaking from one to the other, and sort of marking them explicitly as a way of exposing this to users who are very, you know, concerned about applications doing malicious things. Also, then talk briefly about sandboxing without OS support. So all the sandboxing techniques we were looking at previously sensibly relied on some help from the OS. And the reason why was our thought was, well, the big problem is that the OS lets applications do more stuff than we'd like to let them do. So let's change what the OS does and have the OS give us features that allow us to filter what operations and applications allow to do, what files they can access, what system calls they can make. But we can actually achieve pretty meaningful sandboxing without having that sort of special support from the OS. And a big reason why we want to do this is that communicating from inside this sandbox to outside can be more efficient because we don't have to involve the OS in that process. We saw one idea for doing this in that we take our C and C++ applications, compile them to something like a language VM, something akin to the Java Virtual Machine. When the Java Virtual Machine is written correctly, it's not going to just allow some Java code you're running to do just anything. And we can have the same principle apply for C and C++. And a thing which can make this maybe more efficient than it seems like it would be otherwise, like if you think of Java, you think, well, you know, Java has to do all this extra checking that's going to make things slow. It's true that this design, we're going to have these extra bounds checks and other checks on the code that wouldn't be there without sandboxing in some of the OS-supported solutions. But, for example, if we're checking bounds, what we care about is keeping the bounds in the sandbox, that the, you know, the sandbox code doesn't write things outside the sandbox code. We don't actually care for sandboxing about keeping the bounds in the array that that C code may be manipulating. Yes, that might help it from being exploited, but, you know, if we only check that it's in the sandbox, that could be a lot more efficient. And it's one reason why these sort of sandboxing approaches, you know, can be very performance competitive with, you know, doing, you know, some OS level sandboxing or, you know, even writing things natively. And we also did a brief diversion into where I looked at one example of sort of recent work on, you know, what might be an interface for making sandboxing accessible. But I mentioned we kind of aren't there yet. Like the OS level tools for doing sandboxing are there, and there's these big users, you know, sort of mobile OSs like Android and all major browsers, like, do this sandboxing work, but they've mostly had to go through the effort themselves of figuring out how to make those interfaces work. And hopefully we'll get to a point where this is sort of like a standard library feature that you can easily integrate into your application. We saw an example of, like, someone who's tried to do that, but, you know, it's not, like, a clear winner as far as, you know, this is how you do sort of privilege separation or something like that in your application. Then we spent the rest of our time talking about application permissions. And we were thinking about this primarily in the from the example of Android, but the same sort of principles apply if we're doing, you know, some other mobile OS or some non-mobile OS where, again, we're getting these applications or some other plugins, browser extension, something where we want users to like give permission to specific components to do things and make that a useful decision. And we look primarily at sort of human-computer interaction issues, which I think is where the biggest challenges in this space are. And a big problem that, you know, research has shown, you know, when they tried to ask people about, for like example, what permissions meant, whether they like looked at permissions dialog box, is that a lot of the early approaches for this ran into two big issues. One was that they were kind of wasting user time. Is that, you know, users weren't paying attention, and quite sensibly, because most of the permissions information they were seeing wasn't useful. It was telling them things that for most applications, like, didn't matter to them, so they didn't pay attention. It got in the way. And we saw that sort of the recommended fix or one idea about getting around that is to be careful about when you ask users to make these decisions, is that you don't just tell users, hey, you're installing an application, do you want it to allow it to do these things? You want to not, you know, always give that prompt, because, you know, most of the time, you know, the user is wasting their time by reading that list. There's no surprises there, you know, and it's not worth their time. And you want to instead have some workflow where, you know, the user makes the decision when it matters. And ideally, you want to kind of make that decision happen at a point when it will be relevant. So install time, like, that doesn't give the user an idea of whether, you know, does the application really need to make phone calls? But if they're performing an operation which obviously does that, then that's a more relevant decision to them. The other issue we saw as far as viewability went, besides sort of managing not wasting the user's time and distracting the user and making them sort of be habituated to just like clicking through these permission dialogues, is communicating what the permission does. And this is sort of a clarity issue where, well, you can't just assume that when you write it down, the user is going to understand what that means. And we saw examples where sort of the first several versions of Android had these descriptions that, you know, most of us would have made some wrong guesses as to what that permission meant. And this is kind of a big challenge, just, you know, communicating what it means to the user, because, well, you know, it's not like, you know, the file menu where, you know, if you put something, you know, if your first item on the file menu is foobar and no one knows what foobar means and that's how they open a file, you're going to hear complaints about that. But you aren't going to hear complaints if the permission description is wrong unless you check for that. And we saw that that's something we have to think about if you want to make one of these permission systems for some other context. Then we looked at sort of a second issue with application permissions, which is that, well, when we're trying to enforce these sort of fine-grain, you know, controls, we can often miss places because, well, we're usually enforcing them on top of some big OS API, and there's often multiple ways of doing things. So one example was, you know, we wanted to control on Android, they want to control if whether you get access to a device ID, because that can be used to track users between applications. And, you know, they thought, well, how do you get access to device ID? And they said, well, I look up in the Android documentation, I make the Android API call, and that's going to check the permission, so everything's going to be fine. But that wasn't sufficient because Android was built on Linux, there was another Linux way of getting the information. And this sort of thing happened a bunch where, you know, they missed a case in trying to set their permissions. So what they were saying to users was unintentionally inaccurate. And the other example we mentioned was that, well, applications might work together to evade these sort of ideas. Like, if you want to prevent tracking in applications, well, sort of applications can take that tracking information and write it somewhere else for other applications to use. You might say, why are these applications cooperating? And a big thing which happens in the mobile space is that even applications from different vendors will share some library, like an advertising library especially, that would do this sort of work to communicate that information via what you might call a side channel. So, questions about things we covered last time? So the question is, why is on the quiz question for here not B? So what is wrong with question for B? So the big problem with B, so there's the biggest problem here is that you want to automatically grant application permissions when it's safe, but you definitely need a filter to limit this to only things where this decision to allow the user to revoke those permissions later is meaningful. So if the permission, for example, is something which will cause the user to lose money, well, allowing them to revoke that later, not useful. So that's why B is not a good answer. Like, you want to automatically grant permissions that can be safely revoked, but ones that can't, you know, that's not actually helpful, you kind of need to get the user involved there. You don't really have another option that makes sense. Another thing, can we go over question one? Sure. So question one, we're asking about using chroot, and this is without something like mount namespaces or something like that. So our chroot's going to be limited to things as they actually exist in our file system. So if we want to give an application access to a particular directory, the way we're going to have to do that is that we're going to have to choose a directory, and that's all the application can access forevermore. And this is the big problem with A, is that the word processor, if we want to try to use chroot to enforce this idea, well, we're going to find the file the user wants to open, and kind of the best we can do is we can chroot to the directory it's in, but then the word processor still has access to everything else that's in that directory. And you might think of, well, let's copy the file somewhere else, but then how do you let the word processor save to the original? You don't really have a way of doing that. So I don't think it's practical for A because for that reason. And also, another issue with A is that some code needs to run chroot, and chroot is something that we don't just let any user do all the time. You know, so it's not clear where the, you know, potentially vulnerable code would run. Well, not where the potentially vulnerable word processor would run chroot in a way which would make it run at a time that's, you know, early enough that we wouldn't worry about the vulnerable code doing something bad. Especially if we want to allow opening a new file after opening the first file, right? Because if we chroot for the first file, how can you open another file? Does that explain things for question one? Other things? Okay, and a question for question two, why wouldn't C work? So, so if we have a compromised web server, we kind of need to let it talk to remote machines and probably just any remote machine, because anyone who can contact the web server can contact the web server. And the compromised web server could decide to, you know, if we put something special in the request, to just send back the logs. And that would be sort of how the attacker could implement see and make sure it sends those logs to remote to the attacker's machine. So as long as the attacker can use the web server as a client, you know, they have that network access. And, you know, if we want the web server to be useful as a web server, we can't really restrict that. Does that answer that question? Why C wouldn't work for two? Or other questions? I'm not seeing yes or no on whether I explained 2C. Okay. Okay, so I'm not getting response. I will move on and see if we get questions later. Okay. So, a note unchallenged. As I announced, the assignments released briefly. The schedule showed the wrong due time. It's due 9 p.m. on 12 May. It's not midnight. That's so I can start grading the final maybe a little earlier. And also grading the challenge maybe a little earlier because I want to make sure I actually get grades in on time and preferably have some time for you to, like, tell me if I graded your final or challenge wrong. Okay. So our topic for today, we're going to talk a little more about a topic we mostly talked about earlier in the semester, which is about mitigations for sort of memory exploits. So we talked about a whole bunch of way of mitigations that, you know, dealt with making so the attacker can't write working code, with protecting code pointers, and preventing out-of-bounds accesses in general. We talked about all these sort of mitigations. We're going to talk about something which is kind of in a different space and kind of in this validating protecting code pointer space. So we're going to talk about another idea in this space of, you know, making sure code pointers are actually intact. So I'm going to talk about two mitigations. I'm going to start with a very simple one. And both of the mitigations we're going to talk about today are things which are going to sort of have this common theme of something where there's some hardware support, which makes them a lot easier to implement and makes them surprisingly efficient if you have a little hardware help. So one mitigation to start with talking about is a very simple idea, which is very related to stack canaries. So with stack canaries, we saw that, well, we can keep check whether things are modified in the stack by putting a canary value next to the sensitive data that's on the stack, and therefore detect whether that sensitive data is changed. And another idea is that rather than, you know, trying to keep that sensitive data on the stack, let's keep it somewhere else. Because if we think of address space layout randomization, you know, we might be able to keep this address secret, and generally it's going to be harder to access, you know, using, this is going to just generally be harder to access with an information leak. We have some completely separate region. You might say, what do I mean by sensitive data? Well, I talked about protecting code pointers. So the main one we're going to talk about with the stack is going to be return addresses. So rather than protecting return addresses on the stack by putting this sort of supposedly secret value next to them, let's just put them somewhere else. And this idea is often called a shadow stack that will have our main stack, and somewhere else we'll have this shadow stack with its own stack pointer. And whenever we want to push or pop a return address, we'll just place it on this shadow stack. And now if I have, you know, a buffer overflow in bar, well, it can certainly overwrite things, but it's going to be real hard for it to easily hit these return addresses here. because they're in a completely separate area of memory. And this is, like, fairly simple to implement, except there's this overhead issue. It's just that we have, you know, two pointers to keep around. Maybe that's a bit of work. But otherwise, it's actually very simple to implement. Basically, we just use a different stack for call and return, and then switch back to the quote-unquote normal stack when we're not calling or returning. So this is an idea which has been implemented, and a common actual implementation is that rather than having this idea of storing the return address only on the shadow stack, sometimes we'll end up storing sort of two copies of the return address. So we'll have the return address for Baz stored and the return address for Bar. Right. So the stored on both stacks. And we'll basically use the shadow stack as a way of checking that. Or we'll ignore the extra that's here. And you might say, why would we do that? So one reason why you might do that is that it would allow you to quote-unquote do a normal call and return and add this. Another reason why is that this would allow you to implement it and still be compatible with some other tools. So a way this might look in x86-64 is that let's say we want to do shadow stacks and we'll use R15 as our shadow stack pointer, and we'll do this idea of storing two copies of the return address. So we'll do a normal call, which will push the return address onto the normal stack, and then we'll just copy it back to the shadow stack. So here I'm taking the return address right out at the beginning of my function, copying it to the shadow stack, and you know, one way I can implement this is just before I return, I compare the two. Another way I can implement this is I could, you know, jump instead to the value I got from the shadow stack, assuming it didn't get changed. So the question, wouldn't this be a huge overhead for a recursive function? Yeah, so this does seem a little bit slow for a recursive function. So something which is less bad that we could do is that we could replace the call and return. So at least we aren't storing two copies of the return address. So here, what I do instead is I just, this is basically push after call onto the R15 stack. So here, this is basically like a push, except we're using a different stack pointer that I've written out a call. And I replace the call and a return with this sort of manual way of using that shadow stack rather than ever storing anything on the stack. And this is gonna probably be less overhead, but it's probably still a little overhead for a recursive function. Okay. And so I've kind of shown this notional way of doing it in x86-64, but there's a place where this is actually being done in practice right now. And this is on ARC64, this is 64-bit ARM. Why are we high? Apparently, I'm not reading things on my tablet. Interesting. So 64-bit ARM, and apparently that part of my tablet is broken, which is cute. Huh. So 64-bit, wow. So 64-bit ARM, and they, with Android on that platform, they by default have shadow stacks enabled, and what they do is they just say, well, ARM has a whole bunch of registers, so they dedicate register 18 to the shadow stack pointer. And the ARM calling convention, rather than pushing the return address on the stack in the call instruction places the return address in register X30. So they have code where rather than, as you normally would, saving, say, the return address to the normal stack, which is what this STP instruction saves two registers to the normal stack, they will save the return address also to this shadow stack. So these ST stands for store. So here they're just storing the return address and something else they need to use to the normal stack. Here they're storing it to both the shadow stack and the normal stack, and before returning, they're loading it back from the shadow stack. And this is something that they've just made the compiler do. And if you have a spare register, it's very low overhead, right? If you weren't using X18, then this is pretty trivial. And you could imagine that maybe there's a little extra optimization the compiler could do here of removing this extra X30 here. You can save that. So ARM has this shadow stack stuff, and Intel also wanted to get in this game. So there's a future Intel extension which adds shadow stacks as kind of a feature of the call and return function. And the way Intel decided to implement it is that they have a new shadow stack pointer. So this is a new register. Why do they have a new register? Well, unlike ARM, they didn't actually have a register 18. x86-64 doesn't have that many registers. So they made a new register for this, maybe also because they probably were more concerned that they wouldn't have enough registers otherwise. And they do this very special thing where the call and return instructions are special, and you can mark a region of memory as read-only in the page table, so you can't write it with normal instructions. Only call and return can write it because there's some extra bit identifying it as the shadow stack. So the shadow stack pages have this special read-only, except for call permission. So this idea of implementing a shadow stack where it's protected like this means that the shadow stack is sort of not writable, even if you have some sort of exploit that can write to an arbitrary memory location. So you remember how we talked about like getting around sort of stack canaries by being able to write to an arbitrary location? Well, that same idea would, if we could figure out, say, this location here, that same idea would allow us to overwrite this address if we knew where it was. But in Intel's implementation, they gave you a way of marking it such that that wouldn't work. That you, in order to overwrite it, you need to figure out how to execute a special call instruction with the shadow stack pointer at the right place, which seems really difficult. Since also the shadow stack pointer being a special register, there's not an easy way of just setting it. So these two ways of implementing shadow stacks have these different ideas, where the Intel's way, actually prevents writes, and the sort of ARM64 version where we just had a separate register, it still is stronger than stack canaries. So with stack canaries, we were worried about the stack canary value being leaked, if we had sort of any sort of information leak. With the scheme that ARM uses, well, the shadow stack pointer is hard to leak because it's a special register. Like, there's nothing that's going to just write x18 randomly to the stack, because we can just have this convention that we always keep it in a register. so it's unlikely to leak through our usual information leak stuff like reading uninitialized data. And if we can choose a random location for it, then, you know, it's actually pretty hard for an attacker to, you know, manipulate the shadow stack. Because unlike sort of other things where we thought, oh, you can defeat ASLR because any pointer gets it, we can make it so you need to have a shadow stack pointer stored somewhere for some reason, and that should never happen, right? We should never take it out of this X18 register. So you might say, well, you know, it's nice that to have this extra hardware feature, or it's nice to have sort of an extra register so we can, you know, be helpful that we can just prevent information leaks, but that doesn't seem really practical if we want to like be backwards compatible. And in the early days of these ideas of the shadow stack approach, people tried to do the idea of protecting the shadow stack from modification except when we were calling or returning. But as you might guess, it has really, really bad performance. Really, really bad performance versus not doing that. So this read-only idea is, let's say we didn't have that special processor feature to like only make it writable on call. Let's just set it read-only when we're not calling. Well, if you do that, you know, your performance, you're 10 times worse for typical programs like GCC or CTAGS programs you might care about being fast, like GCC. And you know, you could get good performance with the idea of just putting it at a memory location that should be either hard to guess or surrounded by guard pages, which is what this mind zone idea is, just surrounded by guard pages. But that's why we've arrived at, well, you know, maybe a little hardware help is nice, you know, if you want to actually do it. So the question here, I mentioned in CAT that they decided to push and pop from both stacks. So you might say, why did they do that? And this is, I think, a backwards compatibility choice, right? That a nice thing about this idea is that it seems like we can just take an existing unmodified program and add shadow stacks to it without it knowing, right? Because calls and returns should happen in these pairs anyways, so we can just change how call and return works and the program doesn't need to know. And I think this goal is why Intel writes to both stacks. So if the program, you know, is used to its stack pointer changing from call in a particular way, well, we don't break that. We make it still work, but you actually have this extra protection on a potentially unmodified program. And I think that's a nice goal. And it mostly works without changes. There is some stuff that we need to worry about. And the big case that happens in real programs is exceptions. So in C, if I throw an error and catch it, this code, you know, we need to do something to the shadow stack to make it work. And this is something we need to worry about. And there's a similar problem in C where C has something equivalent with set jump and long jump, which is, this is basically equivalent. So the set jump is basically equivalent to like a try block, and this long jump is equivalent to a throw, kind of like what you saw here. So to make this work with shadow stacks, you know, that's not going to be transparent. We can't just change how call and return works. But fortunately, these are sort of parts of the standard library. So sort of Intel's idea was that you could turn on this shadow stack feature and run an existing program and just change the library that implements exceptions to support it. And then you'd take these unmodified programs and have them have this extra protection, you know. And this is like better than stack canaries because both it's sort of a much stronger protection than stack canaries, like information leaks don't help. And because, you know, we don't have to recompile programs. Like stack canaries, the compiler needs to add code here. You know, if the processor is going to change how call and return works, we don't need to add any code. So questions about this shadow stack idea? and
go back to our
So the question is, where is the shadow stack in memory? So this is something where we have a bunch of choices. So one, there's a bunch of different implementations. So one idea is that we just choose a memory location, so any, and because we're maintaining two pointers, you know, we can put it wherever. Something that some of these schemes sometimes do is that they will keep it at a fixed offset from the normal stack, so it's easy to find corresponding shadow stack entries. And why you'd want to do this is because it makes implementing something like this exception handling, you know, this throw easier, because you have to change both stacks to do that. And both are approaches I've seen with kind of different trade-offs, where, you know, sort of the main concern is how much, where do you keep the extra stack pointer? You know, how much work is that? And how do you deal with this sort of exceptional control flow where we need to, you know, go up in the stack, in both stacks, if we have a shadow stack. Okay, other questions? So let's do... So let's say we have an information leak that can dump any part of memory. What do we would we expect shadow stacks to stop? Okay, so most people answering. So let's go, I'll go through our most popular answers. So people say C. So C is describing, you know, using sort of a stack overflow to overwrite the return address. We would expect this to stop because if we think of our, you know, our memory layout, we have our stack with the return address like here. Sorry, with the return address where that would usually be here, but actually it's on our shadow stack. And our overwrite is going to like get part of this. It's not going to be able to go this far, you know, without breaking other things, probably running into the guard page. So this, I think, would be stopped, you know. So we can't get to the real return address on the shadow stack. From the end of the buffer. And, you know, even if we can get to other memory, you know, to get to the shadow stack, we're going to have to, like, go through a guard page or something like that, so it's not going to work. So then for A, using a format string entry to point the stack return address to the system function. So this is probably. So assuming we don't know the shadow stack pointer. If we do, you know, if we can get the shadow stack pointer by dumping arbitrary bytes memory, then that would be a problem. Then this would not be stopped. But assuming we can't find out the shadow stack pointer address, then yeah, we'd stop A. So then other things. So our next most popular is B, which I think is definitely not stopped. So this format string exploit, we'd overwrite a vtable to point to the system function. And you might say, oh, but in order to like call this function, it needs to use the shadow stack. And that's true. But when we use the shadow stack, well, we're going to do call, you know, vtable of index. And that's just going to happily write something to the shadow stack because that's what the call instruction does. And the call instruction is not going to see anything wrong because the shadow stack's not going to disagree with this call. So I don't think B would still be allowed. And most people said also that, oh, and I missed D, which was actually the next most popular because it got obscured in my view. So D was more popular than B. And D says, using the buffer overflow to overwrite the save stack pointer value to use a different address. So I think D should generally be probably not. We need to change the shadow stack pointer. So in order for this to be useful, we need to also change the shadow stack pointer in a meaningful way. So if the shadow stack pointer were computed from the stack pointer, that would be a problem. Sometimes that happens, but that would still be more difficult because we need the shadow stack pointer to also use the same different address. But probably this wouldn't work mainly because we wouldn't, unless saving the stack pointer somehow changed the shadow stack pointer. So D should be, D, I think, is not a good answer for this. Because we need to also change the shadow stack pointer. We need some way of changing that. Right. Because if we think of our, you know, scenario here, what we'd be doing in D is like we'd be changing the stack pointer to like point here, but the shadow stack pointer, if it still points here, return's going to return to the return address for Baz, not the return address. Oh, which ones are prevented? Oh, right. Sorry, I confused myself. Yeah, so D would be prevented, so it is a correct answer. This is what I get for being too negative. So D, yeah, should be a check mark. Yeah, so it would be prevented. So probably prevented. Why is my tablet not writing today? Because I might need to change that. Sorry, yeah, so D would be prevented, B would not be. So A, I should use red also to be consistent here. So D would be prevented because we wouldn't also be changing the shadow stack pointer. And E would not be prevented because we don't, again, for the same reason B wouldn't be. And consistent color. Sorry for confusing myself about what question I was asking. Other questions about this exercise? Okay, so we talked about validating sort of return addresses by looking at, you know, sort of a backup copy of them here, or in this case, like a better protected primary copy of them, depending on how we're using shadow stacks. Sort of another idea that you might have for validating return addresses is rather than looking at, you know, having them stored in a special case, we could try to think, well, if we have a call to a function, you know, we can make sure we're returning to a place where we actually called that function. Some of you who are thinking about like recursion and things like that might be thinking about tail calls. We'll ignore that for now. But I'm using this to introduce sort of a more general idea that's going to apply for more than just checking return addresses. For protecting code pointers. So rather than, you know, checking whether the return address is really the one we stored, we could do this thing where when we get a return address, we look at where it's returning to and see, was this preceded, was the previous instruction a call? Because if it wasn't, well, that's really suspicious. And was it a call for, you know, this particular function that I expect to be being called? So this is an idea for, you know, just checking returns, you know, assuming we don't do any weird, like, jumping between functions. Question, so why are we subtracting 5? So assuming 5 is the length of the call instruction. So assuming that will get us to a call instruction that was just before, you know, where we're returning to. Because our return address would point just after the call instruction. Other questions, follow-ups? Okay. So this is something we could implement. It's pretty annoying actually to do, you know, this computation here. Is this really a function calling this function? So I have a different idea for doing that. That's maybe a bit more practical. And that's, we're going to add a new instruction that's going to be a special type of no-op. And it's going to be called, I'm going to call it label, and it's going to take an ID. And its encoding is going to have a 2-byte opcode and a 4-byte constant, which is this ID. And the purpose here is just to mark a location in the code. So we're going to have this convention where every time we call, say, the function foo, we're going to have a label instruction with a particular random ID that we've assigned to function foo afterwards. And at the end of function foo, we're going to check whether the place we're returning to has that ID by reading this 4-byte constant from the instruction. And if it's not there, we're going to crash the program. Otherwise, we're going to keep going. So questions about this strategy here? So the question is, why did I write 2RDX instead of RDX? Because we have this 2-byte opcode at the beginning of this label instruction that I want to skip over. Other questions? So this idea kind of looks very similar to stack canaries, but it has some advantages that sort of stack canaries don't. Like you might say, oh yeah, we have this sort of secret ID, but this ID doesn't need to be a secret. You might say, well, why not? Well, but if we think of what would the attacker need to do to make this, to you take advantage of this ID being not secret? Well, they need to write some code to jump to that is executable, because you need to jump there, that contains this ID. And assuming we implement write X or execute, so assuming there's no, you know, writable memory that's executable, the attacker can't do that, right? They can put this ID in their buffer, but it's not going to be useful because when we jump there, it's not, if, you know, if they could write that buffer, it's just going to crash. And this would mean that with write X or execute, the attacker can't write new places for the return to go. So they're going to be limited as far as things like a return-oriented programming attack to places this function could actually return to. You know, they can't make up new ones. And also, you know, this avoids an attack that sometimes people worry about with stack canaries, where, you know, if we change the stack pointer, we can often make programs do crazy things. Here, well, we can change the stack pointer. You know, with stack canaries, that would give us a way of just avoiding the canary in some ways. If we, like, found another place on the stack with a canary here, well, if we go to the wrong part of the stack, the labels are still not going to match. So the question, couldn't the exploit brute force to get a good ID? So the attacker, to find a place to return to, you know, the attacker needs to find the ID in the existing application plus library code. So in order for them to return somewhere, they need to find that ID in the existing code. So question, is the ID randomized in each run? No. But because the ID is this sort of 4-byte random value, you're not just going to find it in random pieces of code, right? It's going to be rare. So it's going to be very rare. So like if you're searching for like a return-oriented programming chain, if the chain needs to have these IDs, you know, it's going to be pretty unlikely you'll find anything useful because, well, you know, if this is a random ID, we think of like, oh, you have like a 1 in 4 billion chance of having anything that might be a useful piece of code having this ID there already. Other questions? So you might say, okay, so this seems like a nice strategy. It has some advantages over stack canaries. Can we use it instead of stack canaries? And there's things this doesn't stop that stack canaries do, which make it sort of not actually a good alternative. But we're going to see why I'm going to mention it in a second, because there's other things we can use this strategy with besides return addresses. And sort of one example is that, well, you know, we can have some function, like in this case, say, sort list, that's called from two different places. And if the attacker can manipulate our return value, like let's say, you know, the attacker finds a vulnerability in sort func1, or, you know, there's some way where they can write from another core over the stack, they can make it so, you know, innocent calls sort list, and sort list returns to dangerous. And why would that be okay? Well, dangerous actually called sort list, so it's a valid place to return. So there could still be places where you could return, which would be a problem, but they are going to be a lot less common than, you know, if we were just, you know, not using this at all. But it's not going to be this like stack canaries, where usually stack canaries would prevent us from, you know, having this sort of thing happen, you know, assuming the stack canary actually remains secret. So questions about this idea of what the attacker would do to take advantage of this situation? Okay. So where this idea of having these labels about where jumps are supposed to go is really nice is that, well, return address is just a type of, you know, a jump to a code pointer. And we can use this for other code pointers. So let's think of, for example, this case where I have a class with a virtual function. So we have this function bar, it's overwritten in B, and this function example here, it's going to call bar, and it's going to work by getting the vtable out of object, reading the first vtable entry, and calling that. And we can apply the same strategy we apply to checking the return instruction to check this call instruction. And what we'll do is we'll assign a label to this bar function, you know, to all the types of bar functions, we'll assign the same label. So I just assigned a random number here, and we're going to label all the bar functions in that way. And now, before I make this call, I'm going to check that label and see, oh, you know, is this thing I got from the supposed vtable actually a bar function based on the label being there? And now this means if the attacker has some way of overwriting the vtable address, well, they can only usefully point the vtable entry to actual bar functions or something where they got really lucky and this label existed in executable memory already. questions about this checking idea here? And we could combine this idea of checking the vtable call. We could also check the vtable return. And something to note here, and something which kind of happens a bit, is that in this case, I had this call which could return to, you know, one place from two different functions. Like this could be two different, either called A bar or B bar. So in order to make this work with that checking strategy, I needed to have the same label for the return. But notice that what I can do is when I'm making these labels is I can kind of divide all my calls and returns and other sort of uses of code pointers into these distinct categories and give each category a label. So I've shown protecting virtual function calls and returns. We can also apply this idea to other calls through function pointers. So one example here, something that comes up commonly in real programs, is let's say we're passing a pointer to a compare function here, which we call via a function pointer. And we could also protect this in this way, but in order to make this work, we have to do something a little tricky, which people have figured out how to do, is which that we have to detect that something's a compare function and make sure all the compare functions in some way have the same label. But if we can do that, you know, if we can somehow label the compare functions, we can also make it that way. So if an attacker can overwrite this function pointer, well, they can only usefully set it to something which is actually used, you know, as a sort function compared. You know, they can't make up new functions. And so what we've seen here is that, you know, we're substantially limiting what the attacker can do when they can overwrite code. It's not clear that we're always, like, really preventing all sort of actual problems, but we're sure making it harder and in some cases probably impossible. Okay. And this idea has been implemented a bunch, and this is commonly called CFI, or control flow, I remember this acronym, yeah. Integrity, that's the word I was looking for, integrity. Because we're trying to enforce that things jump to the right location only. And, you know, this was sort of pioneered in a 2004 paper that used this label-based approach. And so they did a bunch of analysis to assign these labels on a program. They tested it on a bunch of benchmarks. And the overhead varies between programs because, you know, sometimes these label checks are very expensive and sometimes you essentially never run into them. So their overhead range from 0 to 45%, depending on what function program they were using. And there's some more recent implementations where for doing parts of this checking, for checking vtable dereferences, you know, if with better versions of this, for the just the vtable calls, they got 0 to 10% slowdown. And for other indirect calls, like, you know, calls that look kind of like this, they got 0 to 6% slowdown. But as we'll discuss later, they're doing maybe something a little less precise for these other indirect calls. And sort of the general sort of generalization of this is that, you know, we're going to apply this to a whole program. You know, the way we can think of it is that we kind of draw a graph in the nodes and edges sense of how code can move between programs. And we're going to assign, you know, a label to each destination on this graph that we can check. And we can do in a compiler, and compilers already kind of produce this graph internally because it's useful for like doing optimizations. And every time I should say in edges, so every in Edge gets the same label, but we can like use this graph to assign distinct labels. And that's what's sort of, this is the diagram from the original paper in 2004 proposing this. So you see that here, they're saying, oh, we call sort, and sort calls this thing through a function pointer. So we look at all the possible things it can call, which we compute by doing some actually pretty complicated analysis by figuring out all the ways sort is called, and figure out it can call LT and GT, and therefore assign them the same label. And also we look at, oh, you know, we have this site returning from that. We figure out what label, we assign that label 23, and we make sure everything that returns to it has the same label, and so on. Now, an issue with doing this kind of idea of making this graph and figuring out how to assign labels on it. So one issue is that, well, you have to make this graph for a program, and often that's not so easy. And one reason it's not so easy is libraries. So for example, I have a program here that uses the PNG library. We really like to use this mechanism, but, you know, if we think of compiling my program and the PNG library separately, well, we can't really do that and use this control flow integrity approach, because I want to assign a label here and a label here for these calls, for these jumps that come from the PNG library to my code and vice versa. And from, we want to assign labels for that. But sort of the approach we had for assigning these labels was looking at this graph for the whole program. And if we're thinking of compiling the blue part separately from the yellow part, that doesn't seem to really work. We're going to need something different. Another issue with this approach is that, you know, we have some imprecision. That, you know, I have this idea here that for the sort function, I can figure out, oh, it calls LT and GT. And that was simple because, well, I could just track, you know, that, oh, LT and GT was assigned here, you know, was an argument here. But that's not always so simple. You know, like, for example, here, I have a function pointer P, and your question might be, you know, does this call function B? And figuring this out is pretty tricky, right? We have to figure out, you know, what this does and whether this part of foo gets reached or not. And typically what the compiler is going to do is it's going to make a conservative guess. It's going to say, well, there's some obscure way of assigning function B to P. And we're going to assume that example can call that. But that might not actually be right. This might not actually be possible. And this especially might be true if, you know, this isn't function B, but, you know, some other function result or so on. Like, the compiler is going to make a graph like this, but it's going to be an approximation because it's going to have to guess about what things do. It's not going to be able to completely analyze the program. And, you know, commonly what we'll do is we'll like try to like get the full set of possible values. But that gets really tricky. So compilers will do this sort of analysis where what they'll do is, you know, the simplest thing is like for every single variable you track its possible values by saying, oh, it has no possible values. Then let's look at every possible assignment and say its possible values are the union of the thing being assigned and all its previous possible values, and repeat this until we reach, you know, until nothing changes. So this is sort of an algorithm which does that. That's the conservative way. But it's, you know, pretty tricky. And often you'll end up saying, when you do this sort of analysis, you know, often the result will be, you know, sort of all functions of the same type or something very similar to that. Just because it's not going to be easy to limit this set down we think of a big program. But compilers do try to do this analysis for other reasons, which is why, you know, this control flow integrity approach can often get some pretty, you know, good idea about what's possible. So another issue with this approach is that assigning labels is not always so simple, because we might have sort of this weird overlap here, that here I have like two calls through function pointers, and let's say I figure out that foo can call A or C and bar can call B or C, and we can't assign a single label that makes this work without letting foo call an additional function. That might be dangerous. And, you know, sort of there's two fixes for this. So one fix is we could check for multiple labels, but that's going to make things slower. And we're really concerned about overhead here, because we're making every function call slower effectively. Or another idea is we could, you know, just say, well, I guess we're going to allow foo to call B and bar to call A, even though, you know, that's not so easy. So I mentioned when talking about sort of actual implementations that there was this original implementation in 2004, and I mentioned this 2014 paper, which had an implementation that was partially in Clang and GCC, and you might infer from that that Clang has an actual implementation of this idea. Now, Clang's implementation makes some compromises. So one thing is that it doesn't check in all the cases where we have control flow transfers. Like, it doesn't check returns. It only checks calls via vtables or function pointers. Why not check returns? Well, I think the big idea is you're going to use stack canaries or shadow stacks anyways. Why bother? Another limitation is that they deal with this problem here by saying that you're going to have to use libraries that are specially compiled to do this. That we're not going to work with normal libraries. You have to, like, work to have everything compiled in this way. And they've decided not to put the label information in the code. Instead, they have a separate data structure. And they, you know, but it's the same idea. But they use this trick to kind of store the label information, where rather than having these labels in the code, they keep related functions in one region of memory. So for example, let's say we have a whole bunch of comparison functions which all should have the same label. The way that Clang will implement that is that it's going to assign the same label for that, and it's going to assign the label probably by giving the same label to functions with the same arguments. So functions of the same type are going to be put together. And rather than getting a pointer to the actual code for the function, they'll give you a pointer to this sort of this special code in this special region where every function takes up 8 bytes and just jumps to the real code for the function. So this is where your function pointer will point. So when you call, when you get a pointer to the compare alpha function, your function pointer points here. If you get a pointer to the print two strings function, your function pointer points here. And when we're doing the check for what for the label, rather than looking at the code that's here for a label, the check is going to be that before making the call, we're going to take the function pointer we get. We're going to round it to a multiple of 8 because, you know, this is going to be at here. This is going to be start plus 0, start plus 8, start plus 16, and so on. And we're going to make sure that it ends up between the start and end of function pointers of this type. So in this case, these are all the valid function pointers in the program for a function with two string arguments. So the compiler set up this region where these are all the things we take function pointers with two string arguments. So if it's not in that range, we crash. And if it is in that range, then we can do our label check. And rather than actually looking for a particular label, we'll have this bit mask that's stored with the call. And this, in this case, says, oh, probably should be a 0 here, that No, there should be another zero here. This says that we allow compare alpha. We don't allow run with arg. We don't allow print to strings. We don't allow move file. We allow compare reverse alpha. So our list of functions is yes, no, 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 yes. Yes, no, 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 yes. And we check that bit in that array to figure out whether the call should be okay. So questions about this idea of rather than storing a label and looking at that address, we look at the address and sort of, because we've laid out the function pointers we get in a particular way, you know, by setting up the functions like this, we just check that address.
So why do we round initially? Shouldn't it already be pointing to a correct function pointer?
So like it should be correct. The question is, why do we need to round? Shouldn't it be pointing a correct function pointer? Remember, our assumption is that the attacker corrupted this function pointer.
Gotcha. Okay.
So we're doing something where we don't have to worry about that. And in particular, we want to round because we're going to do this offset divided by 8. And we want to make sure that if we had a pointer like between these two functions, that wouldn't cause a problem. And so rounding to a multiple of 8 makes that like at least well-defined what's going to happen. Does that answer that question?
Yep.
Okay. Other questions? That's a good question. So you can see that this is equivalent to that labeling idea, but like it solves two problems. So one is that it kind of, you know, lets us keep the labels separate from the code, you know, rather than polluting our code with all this extra stuff. Another problem is that because we're using these bit masks, we've solved the issue of how do I deal with, you know, this case where I can call, you know, different subsets of these functions. So question, isn't this a goldmine like the global offset table for attacks? So this is code. So this is going to be code that is read-only. So because this is just code, right, it's jumps. This is not something the attacker can edit. It's not something that's ever going to change after the program gets loaded. That's a good question, yeah. We can't just use, like, if we used an array of function pointers for this, that maybe wouldn't be so great. So this trick of kind of keeping the function pointer, the functions in a well-known location by, you know, kind of having these little wrappers is similar to how Clang's CFI implementation deals with vtables. But rather than checking the pointers in the vtables, they actually just check the addresses of the vtables themselves, and they use that rel ro, that mark as read-only for stuff used for relocation. So the vtables read only, and they check the address of the vtable basically, rather than, you know, checking the function address. But it's the same idea for checking the address of the vtable. They keep all the vtables that are valid in a particular region, and they have this bitmask saying where are the valid vtable locations that they check on a call. I guess I'll finish up. Well, no. We'll do this question. So which of these things would we expect to be prevented from calling danger if we called? Sorry, which would we expect could end up calling danger if the attacker controls things? Beforehand. I guess I'm out of time, so I'll say that I don't think so. A and B sort of is a maybe. Depends if pointer is ever assigned to G. Like, even if it doesn't happen in this case, like, then it would be allowed by CFI and to G or danger, I should say. But then in this case, definitely B could possibly do it. As for C and D, so C should not be able to do it because we can only call real F functions. And we shouldn't be able to call g of 1 that way, because 1 should be hard-coded in machine code, and d should not be able to do it. I guess I should have had a none of the above option on the quiz. I am sorry about it. I think this is where I'm out of time. So next time, logistics, I'm going to mostly do exam review. So come with your questions about things you'd like me to go over.
Thanks. Okay.